Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum and your chair for today. I'd like to thank fellow business and leadership member-led forum for co-sponsoring this program. It is my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. You know we really enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. At this time, please turn off your cell phones and other devices. Now, here are some of our upcoming science and technology member-led forum events. On Thursday, September 27th, Frank Hsu will discuss nuclear energy after Fukushima. On Monday, October 17th, we have the science and technology planning meeting. These are just two of many upcoming programs, and I invite you to pick up a copy of the new Commonwealth Club publication in the lobby or check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at www.commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. We are recording and videotaping today's program, so please make sure now that all cell phones and portable devices are turned off. And now, we'll begin today's program. Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening and viewing audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Navi Raju. Navi Raju is an independent thought leader and strategy consultant to leading organizations worldwide, an internationally recognized voice of business strategy and innovation. He's also a fellow at Judge Business School, University of Cambridge. From January 2009 to June 2011, Navi served as the executive director of the Center for India and Global Business at Judge Business School at the University of Cambridge. The center brings together business, academic, and policy leaders and entrepreneurs around the world, eager to shape India's leading role in the global knowledge economy. Previously, Navi was a longtime vice president and analyst at Forrester Research in Boston and San Francisco. He has been featured in Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg Business Week, The Economist, Financial Times, Le Monde, and Nikkei Shimbun. Navi is a regular columnist on HarvardBusinessReview.org. Navi is also sought after speaker by the World Economic Forum, Council on Foreign Relations, the Conference Board, Harvard University, MIT, and Asia Society. A prolific writer, Navi has coined and popularized several business concepts such as global innovation networks, polycentric innovation, and innovation. Navi is currently writing two books on new innovation and leadership models, both to be published by Josie Bass in 2012. An Indian-born French national, Navi earned his MS degree in information systems from École Centrale Paris, and also attended Yale School of Management. Navi lives in Palo Alto, California. Please join me welcoming Navi Raju.
Thank you so much, Shizako, for that very kind and warm welcome. I hope you can all hear me properly. Great. So it's a great pleasure for me to be here at the Commonwealth Club. I have attended several events here in the past when I was living in San Francisco. As a matter of fact, 3 years ago, I was having a blast here in San Francisco. I was working at Forrester Research at that time. The weather was really nice. I had a yoga studio just next to my house. I was going there almost every day. Life was very good. And then suddenly I got this opportunity to go to England and launch a new research center. And of course, I was thinking, my goodness, leaving California, the sunny state, to go to England, very cold and very, like, you know, grim kind of weather. And then I went for an interview, two interviews actually, one in November, one in December actually, in 2008. And both days when I went there in Cambridge, it was very sunny and very warm. And my colleague, Jaideep Prabhu, told me that it turns out that Cambridge is the California of England. It's always very warm and very sunny. And of course, I can see the sky and I confirmed that. So I moved in the early January 2009. The day I moved in, we had a record snow in the United Kingdom. So I told myself, oh my goodness, what am I signing up for here? And then over time, I realized that there was a reason I went there. And the reason is because I spent about 15 years or so looking at the topic of innovation, but primarily in the Western world. And so what Jaideep Prabhu, my colleague, was asking is, hey, why don't you come here to England to help launch a new research center that we are going to call Center for India and Global Business. I think we have a slight technical glitch with the color. No problem. So while we are fixing the video, so this is called the Center for India and Global Business. Hopefully we'll see it in you know, in more colors in a moment. So this is something we launched in early 2009. And the goal of the center was to look at what are some new innovation models that are emerging from countries like India. And then what can we learn from these unique approaches to innovation? And of course, both me and Jaideep, as I said, we have spent decades collectively looking at the topic of innovation. But then we said, let's look at it from a different angle, which is from emerging market angle. And now, what is unique about innovation happening in emerging markets is that when you think about how innovators think generally, they begin with a question, which is, what if? What if I could solve a problem? Interestingly, the way the what if question is asked differs from region to region. So, for example, if you look at in emerging markets, compared to mature markets, the very notion of innovation is different. So in emerging, in mature markets, like, you know, US, Europe, the notion of innovate, right, when you think about the word innovate, it's about changing something established by introducing a new method, ideas, or products. You can think about, like, you know, iPod, for example, or iPad, you name it. These are all some interesting technology products that have come up recently and are rightfully called innovation. But what we found in emerging markets like India is that there's a different approach. It's a more inclusive approach to innovation. So in Indian context, we came up with this concept of innovation, playing on the words India innovation, right? So innovation is essentially a new, frugal, sustainable approach to innovation, born out of necessity. So it's not about a need, desire, but a sheer need that drives it on the Indian subcontinent. And it has a very strong human and global dimension as well. Technology is still important, but that's not really the, you know, the most kind of important attribute, if you like. Now, with that as a kind of definition, what we try to do is that at the center is try to document these innovations. Because we know what is innovation in the Western context. You just look at, you know, any magazine, you know, you can see all the latest gizmos and technology products. But what is innovation? Well, to answer that question, we have to go back to this fundamental kind of question, which is how innovators think. And as I said, in emerging markets, the notion of questioning what needs to be addressed as a problem is different. So in a more mature economies, like, you know, in the Western economies, the kind of what-if question that happens in people's head in the lab would be, what if your fridge can speak to your phone, right? And that's a question that Samsung asked itself and has come up with a very interesting innovation. It's a very smart fridge. and it's called Zippel. And this fridge actually will send your text message to your phone when you're running out of milk, which sounds a very interesting feature. But it just makes a smart fridge, right? That's a great, interesting idea. But if you are living in a country like India, where 600 million people don't have electricity, you really have to think completely outside the box and ask a much bigger what-if question, which is, what if your fridge can operate without electricity, right? That will be a more relevant question. So interestingly, if you can answer that question, you will come up with not an innovation, but an innovation, which is actually a wise fridge, not just a smarter fridge. Now, this question is not a theoretical question that somebody asked themselves. It's actually a person in India who didn't even finish high school who asked himself that question. And he has come up with an amazing innovation or innovation to address this question. And what's interesting is that we have seen many such case studies over the last 30 months as we documented that. And like Mansukh Prachapati, what we found is that these innovators or these entrepreneurs, they are very good actually in cracking the code on how to actually do well while doing good, which is something that we talk a lot about in the West, these days. And so as we looked at these people, these Mansukh Prachapatis in India, I couldn't stop comparing him with somebody else, because this is a guy who actually, of course, is very resourceful in the face of, lack of resources. And he can come up with these very frugal, impressive innovations using very limited resources. And so I told myself, who else has this kind of similar attribute? And for those of you who has watched TV series in the late 80s, can you think of somebody else here in the U.S. who was this kind of guy who can come up with very ingenious kind of solutions using very limited stuff? Exactly, that's right. So for me, India is a kind of MacGyver nation, actually. And interesting, as a fun fact, I watched MacGyver series when I was in France. So it was interesting to see Richard Dean Anderson speak in French, but that's a different kind of story. But interestingly, we looked at these different MacGyvers and trying to essentially figure out what is it that is so unique about the approach undertaken by these innovators? Because clearly they're doing it differently than the way we innovate in the West. So we started documenting these innovations. We set up a website called innovations.net. You can go take a look there. And we have a couple of dozens of actually case studies in, you can see in different sectors actually, ranging from business, science and technology, energy, environment, societal stuff, and even art and culture. There are some very amazing innovation happening in emerging markets like India as well. But as I said, we being, coming from a university, our interest was to say, okay, it's great all this thing is happening, but can we come up with some kind of formal kind of a thinking as to what is this approach to innovation in emerging markets that is so unique about that particular, those regions? And what we first tried to do is to say, is there like a recipe for innovation that we need to learn from those regions? And if there's a recipe, we try to figure out what are some of the ingredients that go into the recipe. So the first thing we discovered is that a lot of these emerging markets tend to have a highly complex environment. And the complexity in a country like India comes from a couple of factors. So I just list four of them here. There's a mind-boggling diversity. And I think any of you who have been to India knows that, we speak different languages, more than 20 different languages. So a solution that works in the north may not work in the south. We have, linguistic differences, we have cultural differences, we have geographical differences. So you need to be able to adapt your solution to different settings. So that also puts a lot of pressure to come up with highly personalized solutions. So anything which is like a mass market doesn't really work there. The second important attribute is liberty. India is the world's largest democracy, and what it means is that you can't just come in and say, here's an innovation, adopt it. You have to really get the traction for it. That means that a lot of the innovators we'll be talking about today, they take a more bottoms-up approach to spurring innovation. So it's much more community-led, much more grassroots-based, as opposed to, something that you develop in an R&D lab, and then you push it down, the throat of consumers. The third element is interconnectivity. India, despite being a relatively poor country, we have about 850 million cell phone subscribers. That's a huge amount of interconnectivity available in the country. So that gives amazing leapfrogging opportunities. And I will give you some example later as well, where you can actually use technology to completely leapfrog some of the stage of development we have been through in the West. So that means that just thinking incrementally doesn't work. You need to come up with radically new business models to take advantage of these technologies. The fourth ingredient, now this is my favorite one, scarcity. Because, of course, scarcity of capital, scarcity of resources, you can name any kind of scarcity, we have it in India, right? But what that means is that you can approach scarcity either with fear and say, oh my God, like in Silicon Valley, right? How do I raise, capital? If I don't have enough money, I'm going to be able not to start, create a startup, right? But in emerging markets, what you see is that these clever innovators say, that's okay, I will come up with a way to do more with less. Right? I will use fewer inputs and generate more output. Right? So that's a different kind of way of reframing scarcity, not necessarily as a bad thing, but as an impetus for coming up with frugal solutions. Right? So that's, if you think about it, what happens is that these innovators, what they do is they are like the mixologist, as I call it. Right? So they take these four ingredients, they put like in a cocktail kind of shaker, right? And what comes out is innovations. So these are the ingredients that lead to this amazing innovation that we'll be talking about today. And now, what are the attributes, distinguishing features of the solutions these people are coming up with? Well, if you want to be really successful in emerging market India, and let's say you're innovating in Silicon Valley, and you go to India and you want to succeed as an innovator, these are some of the important criteria I want to kind of share with you. First, it has to be bloody simple, okay? We hate complexity in emerging markets. And that means that, highly complex cell phones like this one doesn't work. You have to dramatically simplify not only the use of the product, but the maintenance of the product as well. It has to be affordable. That goes without saying. So lower price. But just something being cheap is not enough. And that's something we learned as well to research. So increasingly what we find is that affordability is as important as accessibility. That is, even if you have a cheap cell phone, how do you get it to the people in the villages? So how do you make sure they can, have access to the solution? So accessibility becomes as important as affordability. And then the fourth one is important because a lot of the consumers in emerging markets are highly value conscious. As I say, they may be low earners, but they are high yearners. They have high aspirations. So you need to be able to make sure that the solution, even though it's inexpensive, doesn't come across as a cheap solution. It's something that they really value. And then the fifth one is the idea that it has to be inclusive. So inclusive means that you can't say, oh, these are very poor people, so I'm going to innovate primarily for the middle class. I'm going to ignore all these people, the bottom of the pyramid. Because actually those people may be poor, but as I said, they have high aspirations, and they have some disposable income to spend on your goods and services. But that puts a lot of pressure on you to figure out, how do I include these people as partners in coming up with a new solution, as opposed to just viewing them as consumers? And then, of course, in a way, I provocatively put sustainability in the sixth position because what we find in emerging markets, and you will see a couple of examples in the coming minutes, is that unlike in the West, the notion of sustainability is different. Environmental sustainability rarely figures as a top priority. It becomes almost like a derivative or a byproduct. What they worry about more is economic sustainability, right? How do we make sure that, like Mansukh Prajapati, right? He said, of course it's a green fridge, but he never goes to people and say, do you want to buy a green fridge? It's more about addressing a particular aspiration. And secondly, the way he employed local women. Do you see that in his community? So that was, for me, an example of economic sustainability because he did care after the earthquake that the socioeconomic fabric of his community doesn't get dismembered, right? So that was his primary motivation. And of course, if it is environmentally sustainable, that's icing on the cake, so to speak. And that's something that we found also very, very intriguing in emerging markets as well. So These kind of innovations that embody these attributes, we find that they are being enabled by large companies, actually mid-sized companies and large companies. So this is an example of Chetan Maini. He's actually a Stanford grad, so I have to say this since we are here. He's a Stanford grad and went back to launch this company called Reva, R-E-V-A, which is India's, I guess, one of the world's largest electric car company. Their products are sold, if you go to London and you rent an electric car, it's called G-Wiz in London. Most of the G-Wiz cars are actually made by Reva. And what's interesting is that the cost is about 3 times less than any electric car that you would be finding in Europe or in the U.S. And it's something that he has managed to do out of sheer passion. And more recently, his company got bought by a large Indian company called Mahindra & Mahindra. And that's important because that means that he has come up with a very interesting solution, but it lacked the scale, the wherewithal to go global. And now Mahindra & Mahindra is a company to watch out because they are already beginning to sell some low-cost tractors to farmers in this country. So you can see what's kind of coming up next. So this kind of car will be coming in soon, in the U.S. as well. So that's one example. Another example is it's actually a water filtration system, a water purifier, if you like. It's called Swash, S-W-A-C-H. And this one was invented by the Tata Group, which is one of India's, if not the largest, industrial conglomerate. And the Tata Group is the one that came up famously with the Nano car. You might have heard about that. It's a $2,000 car, which is a very small Nano car, I guess. And they haven't stopped with the Nano car. They're trying to come up with more innovations that are very affordable and accessible to the masses. And this particular filter cost about, I just checked before coming here, it's about $27-$28. And it uses, and that's why I deliberately put the two images next to each other, they are both sustainable because the water filter uses the ash from the rice husk. So it's highly, highly, environmentally sustainable. And what they did is that's something, by the way, people in the villages already do that instinctively. But what these guys did, they industrialized it. They took that and said, how can we scale it up, package it differently, et cetera. And they're selling it to both the, lower middle class in urban areas as well as people, in villages as well. So that's an example of a large company having the resources to drive these innovations. But what I got passionate, and I want to give you more examples, is what you see in emerging markets like India is that a lot of these amazing innovations are driven by a lot of the grassroots entrepreneurs. And these are the people who are right there in the field trying to understand how can I help the local community with a solution that is 100% relevant to their particular needs. And one of them that I'm very happy to introduce you now, Ari Shande is actually somebody, again, who got educated in the U.S. He got his PhD from University of Massachusetts, and he went back about 15, 17 years ago to disprove or debunk a couple of important myths. One of them was that poor people cannot afford clean tech. He wanted to show that that's not true. And secondly, that you cannot run a socially relevant or socially impactful venture without making profit. You want to disprove that as well, right? And so he managed to prove that, and he got really recognized for it because just a few weeks ago, he got the Asian Nobel Prize. It's called the Ramon Magsaysay Award for this year. So that's where it can take you, if you think really outside the box. So we looked at, as I said, the approach of innovation, right? We discussed that for a while. And then we said, okay, if we dig in a bit deeper and not let's look at in aggregate, what is the process of innovation or the approach to innovation, but how these people think, how these innovators think, what is the kind of mindset? And it turns out in India, we have a particular, term to designate that kind of unique mindset. And we call it Jugaad. And Jugaad is something that roughly translates as the gutsy art of overcoming harsh constraints by improvising an effective solution using limited resources. And this Jugaad mindset, I think, is very unique to emerging markets. And if you can, you know, kind of look at the definition and kind of parse it out, you can see it kind of has some key kind of elements of, you know, the unique mindset of these innovators. The first one is that how they overcome harsh constraints in a very artistic fashion almost, as opposed to purely a kind of almost technical kind of fashion. But beyond that, what you also see is the word improvisation. So it's not something that necessarily planned, like, you know, for years and then execute for another couple of years. It's something like Harish did, right? It's much more iterative. It's like, you know, you come up with a solution, go test in the market, get feedback, and then keep improving on it. And then it's an effective solution. And I think Harish also said it's not the best solution. It's an effective solution. May not have all the bells and whistles, but gets the job done. And then finally, using limited resources. So it's a very, very frugal. It's very parsimonious in the use of natural resources as well. And again, because of the scarcity that characterizes its emerging markets. So this Jugaad mindset, we believe, is something that has a very unique set of attributes. And I just list five of them here, because I find that it's something that we can learn a lot from as well. So the first important distinguishing attribute of the Jugaad mindset is optimism. And we have been baffled by how when we come in from, you know, the outside, you go to India, and you kind of say, oh, my God, all these challenges, you know, in rural areas, for example, they don't have electricity. And so if you have Whirlpool and you go to emerging market and you say, oh, my God, they don't have electricity, how can I even sell my fridges, right? But for somebody like Mansukh Prachapati, he says, great, excellent, very good news. So let's see how we can come up with some creative way to deal with that issue, right? So they always see the glass as being half full. And they always see a silver lining in any cloud, however dark it is. The second attribute, I would say, is adaptability and the ability to bounce back from adversity. So in the case of Harish Shande, what he didn't say is that he spent about 10 years laboring through his business model, because he came into India about, I think, in 1995, at the time when solar was too bleeding edge. People didn't understand what the heck this thing was. And so many people, you know, refused to buy a solution, but he persisted. So he really had a lot of fortitude to keep, you know, going, and eventually he succeeded. The third attribute is empathy. People like Mansukh Prachapati and Harish Shande, they really care for their consumers, not in terms of consumers, but as human beings. So they empathize with them, and they really want to help them address their pain. And the process, their pain becomes, you know, the consumer pain becomes their own pain, as you saw in the case of Mansukh Prachapati as well. So, and then the fourth attribute is passion. They are really driven by a larger purpose. And you can see, you know, Chong In Teek, the way that Harish Shande say, right, he's not motivated by money. As a matter of fact, he recommended other entrepreneurs to not start with money because that's going to kill innovation. So you always have to think about a larger purpose you are trying to serve to sustain yourself as an entrepreneur. And then the fifth attribute, of course, this frugality. And that comes naturally in a resource-constrained environment as well. So these are some of the key attributes, if you like, of the Jugaad mindset. But what we found is that Jugaad isn't that unique to India. As a matter of fact, it's prevalent in many emerging markets. And for example, I want to give you two examples of Jugaad in action in two other emerging markets. One is in Brazil, where they have come up with this floating bank. It's like ATM, you know, on not even wheels. It's ATM on the tide, I guess, you know. So, and this is actually to serve the people in Amazonia, right? So it's a floating bank that has almost all the services. You can go bank everything you like. But more importantly, it also offers, you know, social schemes like, you know, healthcare, education type of things as well as a microcredit, which is very important in emerging markets. So that's an example of, you know, a bank that decided to go to the consumers in a unique fashion as opposed to expecting them to come to them, right? Another example I found is a very unique in a way. It's in China. And this is an architect, Naihan Li. I may be mispronouncing her name. I apologize. But she has come up with this mobile furniture. As you can see, they're all on wheels. And the idea was that she moved into a new loft space, and she couldn't find any furniture. And there were the wooden, you know, packing crates. And she said, oh my God, very simple. Why don't I recycle them as, you know, furniture? And it turns out that because a lot of people in China are on the move, literally speaking, so this became a very convenient way for her, you know, to create mobile furniture as well. So, and I think in China there is an interesting concept which is similar to Jugal, which is kind of catching up as well. I think it goes by the name of Chanjai, which is a way of coming up with a good enough solution that may not have all the bells and whistles, but get the job done. Okay. So again, that's an example of Jugad in a Chinese fashion. But interestingly, Jugad also exists in other countries. If you look at in France, it goes by the name of bricolage. But French being French, they tried to be more sophisticated, so they came up with a system for that. So it's called System D. System D. And D, I don't want to say publicly what it is. It's a kind of a coarse term, but essentially means that to untangle yourself from a difficult situation. Okay, and you can see that even magazines that talk about the system D, how do you fix things, using limited resources, for example. Interestingly, what we found is that we started looking at Jugad and we said, you know what, we are talking about Jugad in today's emerging markets, but once even the developed countries like the U.S. were emerging countries. So, and we said, was there Jugad happening like a couple of centuries ago, even in this country? And guess what? There was Jugad going on, even here in the U.S. And I want to give you a couple of examples of Jugad happening in emerging markets today that strikingly remind us of Jugad happening 100 or 200 years ago. So this is an example of a Jugad output, which is a clean stove. Now, a stove may sound very mundane for us here, in the West, but it's a big issue in emerging markets like India because people often use very poor quality stoves. They use poor quality kerosene, low quality petrol, for example. Oftentimes, what happens is it creates a lot of indoor air pollution. As a matter of fact, in India, 400,000 people die every year out of indoor air pollution, and many of them are children. Okay, so British Petroleum came up with a very interesting innovation to address this issue. They came up with a very affordable, first of all, stove, which actually controls the amount of raw material you consume, but at the same time effectively manages the heat it produces. So in this case, it uses actually not wood or petrol or something, but actually pellets made from agricultural waste. So it's essentially biomass, which is also clean. And it goes for about $17, which is very affordable. Now, when we looked at this stove, it's called Urja, which means energy in Hindi. We were thinking, was somebody else dealing with a stove like this in this country? And actually, yes, in 1741, one of our founding fathers, Ben Franklin, came up with something called the Franklin stove. And his idea was essentially at the time they had an open stove, which was very kind of not only polluting, but remember back then the houses were made of wood. So there was a high risk of fire as well as these, smoke and everything came out. And so he came up with this very, ingenious way of limiting the amount of course, raw material use. But his concern was primarily to increase the effectiveness of the stove. So his stove essentially used four times less wood and emitted twice more heat. Okay, so he was a Jugadu innovator back then in 1741. But what's interesting, it doesn't limit with the product itself. I found interesting commonality in the mindset as well. So Ben Franklin, as you know, grew up in a large family. He has 16 siblings. He experienced a scarcity in a way of attention, I guess, in one way or another. And then as he grew up, he also was very keen to come up with inventions that actually made sense also for himself. Several things he did was to address his own issues, bifocals, etc. But then he cared about his community as well. As a matter of fact, when he was offered a patent for the stove, he declined it. He said, no, I don't want to patent it. This has to benefit for the larger community, right? So that, I thought, is a very interesting example of Jugad. Another example of Jugad, which I found intriguing and interesting that happened in the U.S. as well, was about a century later after Ben Franklin. But because we recently came across this interesting innovator in India who has come up with can anybody guess what that is first? Yes, it seemed like a tractor, but then the guy is riding it, right? As opposed to, you know, a regular tractor. So yes, it is a tractor, but it's kind of a special type of tractor. So it's actually a hybrid tractor, if you like. So what this guy did is essentially, his name also goes by, you know, Mansukh, interestingly, and Jagani is last name. Mansukh Jagani actually decided to create his own tractor, okay? And the idea was that he combined the front end of a motorbike and the back end of, a two-wheeled farm tiller, okay? And the result is something, a device that actually costs four times less than even the cheapest, you know, tractor. It can, you know, plow, it can weed, you can, you know, sow as well. You can do almost everything you like with this. And again, when we're looking at this innovation, we were wondering whether we had a similar kind of innovation that happened in this country. Well, in 1834, somebody named Cyrus McCormick came up with the reaper. Back then, most of the harvesting was done manually, right? So this person came up with a very simple way using a horse-drawn type of device to increase the productivity of farmers, okay? And what's, again, fascinating is that he worked laboriously on this invention for many, many months. And when he first showed it to people in 1831, he was given a patent in 1834. But in 1831, the farmers felt that it wasn't reliable. So they kind of booed him. They said, this won't work. But he was very resilient. He insisted. He kept improving it, you know, the design. And he was an amazing, by the way, not just a great inventor, but a great marketeer as well. He was the first guy to start using customer references. He took the references of the first customer and started printing in his brochure. Okay, so he was a great marketer as well. And also, he started this out of his own personal pain. He was growing up in a, you know, farm, and like, you know, Mansukh, you know, Jagani, he can see the pain of his, you know, fellow farmers as well. So that motivated him to come up with this invention as well. So Jugaad did exist a couple of centuries ago in this country as well. But what happened then? How did we lose that? Well, if you look at Jugaad, a best metaphor or kind of imagery to compare it with is a jazz band, right? It's very fluid, very dynamic, very bottom-up. And look at them, right? They have no resources. They have, of course, some instruments. But look, they are playing the street, right? And more interestingly, you can see that they all seem to be concentrated on their own activity, their own kind of, you know, musical instrument. Now, what happened is this fluid approach to innovation, very improvised approach to innovation, we over time lost it. And what we ended up playing is more like an orchestra, right? Very top-down, very process-oriented, requires, as you can see, a big room to play, right, as you can imagine, a lot of resources. And always wonder what happens is, God forbid, the conductor has a heart attack, right? Or any kind of something like that, the whole thing collapses. Nothing happens. Whereas in the jazz band, what happens is that you take cue from each other and you try to kind of up the ante a bit. So the result is a much more fluid approach to innovation. And now, of course, today we have this more structured approach to innovation, which looks like this orchestra, you know, kind of, you know, symphony orchestra, very top down, a lot of resources go in to make it happen. But the exciting news is that we are seeing is that slowly the Western companies are rediscovering this fluid approach to innovation, which is very Jugaad-minded approach to innovation. And this is happening because a lot of the multinationals are now going to emerging markets and they're getting exposed to this new approach to innovation. And companies like General Electric, for example, is one of them, John Deere, IBM, and Cisco, they're all opening labs in India. But when they go and open labs, they don't behave like the orchestra that we talked about earlier. They may act like that here in the U.S., but when they go there, they tend to act more like the jazz band. As a result of that, what we see is some amazing, interesting innovations coming out from India, led by these multinationals. For example, case in point, General Electric has come up with two devices that are pretty impressive. The first one is called the Mac 400. This is an ECG machine that cost one-tenth of what it cost in the Western world, so it's about $1,000 instead of $10,000, but also it's portable. It weighs five times less. So the physician can go to his patients carrying it, as opposed to the patient has to come to see the doctor. Okay. And secondly, it's also very simple. You don't need a technician to operate that. The doctor himself can do that. And this device, after being introduced in India, is being marketed here in the U.S. as well. The second device, which I find quite cute as well, can you guess what it is, the second device on the right?
Handheld ultrasound.
Sorry?
Handheld ultrasound.
It cheats. All right. So it is actually an ultrasound machine. And what's interesting is the genesis behind it is it's called V-Scan. And V-Scan has a very interesting history. What happened is that, and that's why I think it's important, right? Because when GE went to India, they went to rural areas. And they noticed that most rural physicians have essentially two tools with them all the time. They have, of course, a thermometer, and then they have a stethoscope. Right? And so when they looked at these traditional ultrasound machines, the big bulky stuff, they said, oh my God, I can't operate this stuff. Okay, there's no way I can carry this with me, with my patients. And secondly, it's too complicated, very expensive. There's no way I can use it. It's not that they were technophobic. They were not Luddites. Because they all carried one consumer device. Can you imagine what it is? That's right. So their cell phone. So then the aha moment was, okay, what if you can come up with a device, a medical device, that looks like a cell phone, and you can almost see strangely the interface like an iPod, you see? Right? Very simple to use. So that's how they launched it. That inspiration came from emerging markets like India. But then the development took place globally. They used talent from India as well, from China and Norway and U.S. as well. And this device, of course, has a slightly high price. It's about less than $10,000. But as they start scaling up the scale, the volume, the price is expected to come down as well. Okay. And then a third example is from Nokia, the cell phone maker. They got for an interesting shock when they went to India. They felt that, oh, my goodness, very simple. We just come up with a device. It will sell like hotcakes, and everywhere. The problem is a lot of farmers, they felt that, it sounds very shiny, but they don't see the usefulness of the device, right? So they realized that it's not enough that the hardware looks cool, but the value of the content needs to be very relevant to people like farmers. So they came up with a very simple solution to make the Nokia cell phone a life tool, something that enhances the livelihood of the users. So what it does is, in the case of the farmers, every day they receive an SMS text message that has three important pieces of information. One is the weather forecast for the particular region, the price of the crops they're selling, because oftentimes in farmers in the rural areas, what happens is that they don't have access to latest price data, so they get sometime like, conned by, middleman. So this creates price transparency, which is fantastic. And then thirdly, it also tells them about any kind of government schemes they are entitled to, they should be aware of, okay? So very simple, but highly effective. If you're a grape grower in India, just knowing it's going to rain tomorrow makes a big difference, right? So that's an example of, how multinationals are getting exposed to this kind of Jugaad spirit, not exposed in terms of observing what's happening, but their own people in emerging markets are beginning to use that spirit and, mindset to come up with these kind of solutions. And what's exciting for me, and I want to kind of close on the next few slides, is that it's coming back again. We talked about Ben Franklin, we talked about Cyrus McCormick, but Jugaad is again coming back in the U.S., and it's being practiced, interestingly, not only by the large companies, but often by interesting entrepreneurs. Many of you may be familiar with, Sal Khan, who's one of my favorite entrepreneurs. Who knows Sal Khan by chance? Very good. So I think Sal Khan is a very interesting pioneer, right? He's trying to essentially come up with a very innovative business model to make tutoring or education, however you want to call it, more accessible to the masses. Again, very frugal, right? He's a one-man guy, doesn't require any sophisticated, resources, just uses YouTube as his channel, and he has created, 2,500 videos, I believe, right now. And I just checked before coming, he has 166,000 people subscribe to his videos, right, which is a mind-boggling kind of number. Another example of a Jugaad entrepreneur here in the U.S. She's actually here in the Bay Area, Carol Realini. She's the CEO of OboPay. OboPay is a company that makes mobile payments possible. So as you know, mobile payment is a big topic in emerging markets because many people don't have banking accounts in emerging markets. So how do you make financial services accessible to people without having a bank account? Well, one way is to use cell phones. And so essentially you deal with virtual money, like electronic money as opposed to physical money and in the banking system supporting that. So this is a model that started in Africa, interestingly, in Kenya and places like that, very successful, and then went to India. And now, more recently, it's being introduced even here in the U.S. Why that's important? Because, believe it or not, 26 million households in this country are underbanked. Okay, it's a statistic you don't realize. Not unbanked, but underbanked. That means they don't get the full gamut of financial services that we take sometimes for granted. Okay, so she sees an opportunity even here in the West for this kind of service. But what I thought is, rather than segregating, there's an Indian jugaad going on, this American jugaad going on, what if they come together? If we start collaborating worldwide. And remember that famous Rudyard Kipling statement that East is East, West is West, they shall never meet, right? Actually it happens. They can meet, and when they meet, magic happens. And it happens not far from here. I'm getting a bit too parochial, as I realize, because everything is too close. Maybe there's a coincidence. But it's something called the Stanford India Biodesign Program. It's being hosted at Stanford University. And what they do is they bring together innovators who are interested in the medical sector from India and to Stanford, and they introduce them to some cutting-edge thinking in terms of design principles, engineering principles, etc. But then these fellows go back to India, and they start identifying large-scale problems that require affordable, accessible solutions. Okay, and then when they identify them, they identify the problem, do some prototyping. Then they work with their partners here in Stanford or companies in the U.S. to co-create a new solution to deal with any kind of medical problem they found in India. One of the problems they recently addressed is a very interesting solution. It's called a bone drill. It sounds very ominous, but it's a lifesaver. It's a device that is used to deliver fluids into your bone marrow when your veins are crushed after, let's say, an accident or, you're using a machine and you had some problem or something. So when that happens, essentially, you need to have that in, for example, ER rooms have that or ambulances have that as well. But generally, they cost about $300, which is a lot of money for a country like India. So these guys in India said, what if we can come up with a more rustic, rudimentary version of that, which will cost a lot less, but also would be easier to use because it has to be not mechanized. It has to be used with two hands, So it has to be something that anybody can use very easily. That's great as an insight. But then how do you make it happen? They tinkered with it with a few prototypes. And then they said, you know what? We need some really important user interface design people to come in and help us with this. So they asked the guys at Stanford. And Stanford connected them with a company called Lunar Design, which is a very well-known design firm in the U.S. And working with Lunar Design, they came up with this very interesting device, which cost less than $20, okay? They're in the final stages of, trialing this. And for me, this is an interesting innovation that combines, if you like, the kind of jugaad, mindset or jugaad kind of approach innovation of India with the same thing here in the U.S. as well. And the result is a product that not only could be relevant for India, but you can see this easily being used, even here, right? Why this is relevant, I think, this idea that, we need to think about bringing jugaad and addressing some of the issues even here in the West is because we are also facing some of the common issues that I described earlier for emerging markets, right? Scarcity, for example, a lot of companies are cutting their budgets. We are facing scarcity of natural resources, for example. So that is going to force us to think more frugally, right? We can't just keep doing more for more. We have to think about more for less. Demographic shifts is important. Aging population. We have to think about a way of delivering healthcare for the, you know, for them as well at affordable prices. But also, demographic shift for me includes Generation Y, the millennials, who require a different approach when they come to workplace in terms of how they collaborate, how they innovate, which sounds very much like the very fluid Jugaad approach that we saw in emerging markets as well. So that, in my opinion, is going to be another catalyst for adoption of Jugaad as well here in the U.S. And then the rapid technology changes, things like Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, are completely turning upside down the way you innovate. Because in the past, it was a big R&D lab using expensive technologies, coming up with the great ideas, and then go spend years, you know, to develop and launch them. Now what happens is that everybody can go to Facebook and brainstorm on new products and services. As a matter of fact, one CIO, Chief Information Officer, complained to me that they've invested a lot of software to do things like brainstorming, you know, where you get people to think about new ideas, etc. Well, nobody uses software. Rather, they all are going and talking on Facebook, right? That's where they ideate. Well, that's where they come up with new solutions. So you are saying, how the heck am I going to connect Facebook to my corporate IT systems? It's a nightmare. But on the other hand, it's fantastic news because that kind of platform lends well for the kind of Jugaad innovation we talked about so far. But there are some interesting people that I wanted to introduce you as well, where we're trying to deal with the big issue of healthcare. How do you make healthcare more accessible? And one of them is actually, we met in India. His name is Dr. Mohan. He's a famous expert in diabetes. And he has come up with a very affordable way using telemedicine to make diabetes care accessible to the masses in India, which I think is a great example as well. And you can Google him, find more information as well. So with that, I want to thank you for your attention. And I think we'll be transitioning to Q&A soon.
Our thanks to Nabi for his insightful comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening and viewing audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. Innovation, India's rise as an innovation superpower with Nabi Raju. Now we open the floor to a Q&A and we will just take a few questions since we are running out of time. And we have a standing microphone over there. Do you have any questions? We'll take a few questions.
Hi. My question is regarding intellectual property and copyrights. How are they protected slash provided to the innovator or innovator, for example, in India?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Because oftentimes we think about intellectual property as not being a big issue in emerging markets. But actually, if you look at, to pick a few examples, in the case of Mansukh Prajapati, he was supported by an organization called GIAN, which actually, I think it's a grassroots innovation network. What they do is actually they coach these grassroots entrepreneurs to figure out how to patent the invention. So the Mitikool, the green fridge he came up with, is actually patented. Same thing with the other Mansukh, you know, Jagani, is a hybrid, tractor. He also got patent as well. So you see a similar phenomenon happening in China as well, because China got this bad rep of being, kind of a place where IP is not protected. But recently there's been kind of an escalating number of court cases that actually are filed not by multinationals against local competitors, but local companies against local companies or against multinationals, because they are coming up with original inventions and they want to protect that as well. So the IP regime is improving in emerging markets, but more importantly, the point is that the inventors realize that intellectual property and therefore patents is a very important currency if you want particularly to go sell your products in global markets and also defend yourself against local competition as well. So, other questions? Thoughts, comments? I know it's getting late, but great.
Our thanks to Nabi for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as those viewing and listening to this program. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.